Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi there. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what's a podcast?
A podcast is a thing humans invented to procrastinate from doing important things, like actual work or spending time with their families.
Neat. Enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about Chapter 26, Season 2, Episode 13, Somewhere Else. Directed and written by Mike Schur, including guest cast Maya Rudolph, Angela Trimber, Seth Morris, Alan Rachel, Merrill Hathaway, and David Piggott. In the second season finale, the humans await the results of Michael's plea with the judge. Janet confesses her love for Jason. This inspires Chidi to lay one on Eleanor. Michael suggests that the system for judging humanity is flawed, and he and the judge decide the four humans should remain in separate medium places until they can resolve this. Eleanor won't settle for this, though, so Michael convinces the judge to do a new experiment. With the snap of the judge's fingers, Eleanor is back on Earth before she died, and a mysterious figure saves her from her shopping cart death. Janet and Michael watch the next year of Eleanor's life, wherein she decides to become a better person and joins an environmental group. She eventually backslides, which causes Michael to step in as an advice-wielding bartender and give her another little push. Eleanor flies to Australia and meets Professor Chidi Anagonye. My guest today is creator of The Good Place, Mike Schur. Mike, welcome. Everything is great.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yes. Mike, how's it going?
Good, Mark. How are you?
Good. We are in two interesting places right now. Where you and I are in real time is that we've just wrapped about a week ago, season three. Mm-hmm. You are about to, you are conceivably editing, and I'm curious, where in the process of that are you?
We locked the season three premiere, which is 1 hour long, right, yesterday. So I'm going... After we finish here, I'm going to do sound spotting and VFX spotting, which means we go through the episode with the composer, David Schwartz, and with our VFX people, David Niednagel, and who, by the way, was a delight on this podcast.
Wasn't he fun?
Huge fan of him and his insane visual effects.
The most insane fact about David Niednagel that emerged in that podcast was that he has a degree in economics.
That's right.
And... Scandinavian studies?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I did not know that. That was news to me. I learned something from this podcast every day.
My favorite part of that is, as he says that, you hear Mary Beth Monroe, who plays Mindy Sinclair, go, "Oh my God!"
I also, it was adorable that she called you Jackson the whole time. Yeah. That was truly adorable.
Can I tell you something? That was her being formal, because we came up through the Second City together, and everyone in that world calls me Jax.
Really?
Yeah. Part of it is because there was me, M-A-R-C, Mark Evan Jackson, and then there was another guy, Mark, M-A-R-C, Warzeka. So it was Jackson and Warzeka, and apparently we didn't have time for Jackson.
No, you saved so much time by shortening it.
But MB calling me Jackson was like her being like, that's basically Mr. You know what I mean?
That's like, yeah. That's the 19th century formal address.
Exactly.
That's like she showed up at your house and filled out one of those like cards that you put on a silver platter and it was brought into your room.
A calling card. Yes, indeed.
And it said Jackson on it.
Precisely.
Yeah. As I'm here to see Jackson.
The other interesting place that we find ourselves is when this podcast episode is airing, the season three premiere that you've just locked is coming soon, next week. Are you excited for people to
See it?
You almost said hear it.
I know. Podcasts, all of this is weird.
I'm very excited. I think it turned out really well. I think the whole season is very good. I'm cautiously optimistic, I would say, which is about as good as it gets when you're editing things. But I think it turned out really, really well. It's very in keeping with the show as you know it so far, in the sense that it's very sprawling and ambitious and a lot of stuff happens and there's a lot of, in this case, there's a lot of time jumping because as I imagine we'll talk about today about the season two finale, you saw them, you saw everybody in the judges' chambers and then you go through an entire year of Eleanor's life in one episode. And so a lot of the season three premiere is going to be sort of filling in the blanks of what happened with other people in the show, the other characters in the show, with seeing things from Michael's point of view and how he came to do what he does and stuff like that. So there's a lot of like rewinding in the same way sort of that the season two premiere had this, right? In the season two premiere, you went back and you saw each person wake up and then go through their sort of first day. And then you went back and saw them another person wake up and go through their first day. So we do that in the season three premiere to some extent, except it's about entire years of people's lives. So there's a lot of moving around.
In various Emmy panels that we've done and Comic-Con and things, you've said this, so I think it's fair to have you restate it. You said there's no value in being ambiguous. Eleanor is alive on Earth. That's
correct.
Not a simulation. That's not a bad place.
No.
Reboot.
No. She is for real skis on Earth, and all of the other humans are also for real skis on Earth.
Oh, that was my next question.
Yes. The idea behind the... behind Michael's sort of revelation that he has in the judges' chambers is there is some ambiguity in his mind about whether the four humans got better only because they were in this sort of weird one-of-a-kind afterlife simulation. Mm-hmm. They basically performed as humans, ethically speaking, far better than they ever did on Earth. Eleanor became far less selfish and Tahani became very differently motivated for her in her actions, and Chidi became a little more decisive as evidenced by the fact that he kisses Eleanor in that chamber. And Jason is still a ding-dong, but he is a very nice ding-dong and he did some really kind and other directed things over the course of the year, or the 802 reboots, you would say, and was in fact smart enough to actually in one of the reboots to figure out that they were in the bad place. And so Michael wonders whether there's a different way to test the human's ability to become better people.
Right.
Because, as he says, it's supposed to be that when you die, your score is your score, end of story. That's how good or bad you are. It's a flawless system. It's omniscient. It's mathematical. It's computed and you get a result and that's the end. And if that's the case, then it shouldn't be the case that in the afterlife, in any situation in the afterlife, people demonstrate the ability to be better than they were. Right.
Right. That shouldn't be able to change.
So he's wondering how to try to prove it. And he gets this idea to send them back to Earth with a sort of near-death experience moment that causes them to take stock and look at their lives and imagine what would have happened if they had died and all that sort of stuff. And that's what the judge does. She sends them back to Earth in a different timeline where the four of them did not die.
There's something really exciting. It's tiny, but... when Eleanor is saved from the shopping carts and that get hit by the panel truck, she says, "I almost just died." And there is a certain like, "Oh, girlfriend, you have no idea." Like, we've watched you 802 different times do it.
Yes.
Or, you know, not die precisely, but like, you have no idea what you don't know.
Yeah, it's dramatic irony. It's the best. It's one of my favorite things, especially in a show like this that is, at least to some extent, you would call science fiction or genre or whatever you want to call it. Dramatic irony can be really wonderful. It can also be very boring, right? If the audience knows things that the characters don't know, and we talked about this, I think, the last time when we talked about the season two premiere, maybe, I can't remember, but there, or maybe the finale, it can be very boring to wait for the characters to catch up to what you, the audience, already know.
Sure.
So dramatic irony at its best is in a situation where you know a lot of stuff the characters don't know, but the characters are on a new adventure, where they're not... Eleanor right now is not trying to figure out whether or not she's in the bad place, right? Like,
right.
That's what the beginning of season two was about, hustling quickly to get them to the point where the characters caught up to the audience because they were in the same situation they were before, but now she's in a completely different situation, so we can have a little more fun and pace it out a little more because Eleanor is not in the bad place thinking it's the good place. She's on a new adventure. That's the theory, at least.
Do you have a, I mean, your mind for these episodes and the storyline, which is incredibly aggressively disjointed, non-chronological. I started playing golf like 10 years ago, and real golfers, I think, can tell you, like having done it once, what the third hole on this course from 2 years ago was, kind of thing.
Sure.
And I feel like you're able to do that with this show and go like, well, in 212, and then, you know, it was in 107 that we planted the seed that Janet can't eat, or what, like, your brain, how do you keep this straight?
Well, I mean, it's the, you know, aside from my wife and children, it's pretty much the only thing I've been thinking about for the better part of 3 years.
Great save.
Thank you. It's just the thing that I'm doing right now. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, did you happen to see LeBron James was asked about in a post-game interview?
Oh, gosh, yes.
So recently. He was asked, like, you know, tell us about X, Y, and Z. And he went through, like, a multi-play sequence from memory. It just, like,
this person
Kyle Korver hit the three, and then, you know, they were in transition, and there was a cross-court pass over here, and then the ball was tipped out of bounds. And he just walked through, very casually, just walked through, like, many, 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 many plays.
Like 2 minutes worth of
yeah.
who passed to whom and yes. off the backboard and an inbound.
And you can watch a video of it split screen with the actual action, and he's exactly right. And I've seen other people in other sports do that. Bill Belichick, the coach of the New England Patriots, has done that before with
Boo.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I know. I know how everyone feels about Bill Belichick, including me, and I'm a fan. But they have just sort of photographic recall
right.
of various events, and I feel like that's just because that's the thing that they do. And
I guess that's true. I have that for dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Kristen Bell has that for dialogue. Kristen can recall. I mean, to be fair, or to explain it in a slightly different way, this has also always been my, if I have an X-Men superpower,
that's it.
In my life, this is it. Memory is it. And I have, like, I can hear a song that I haven't heard in 25 years and I still know all the words. And as a writer, I can remember, like, specific plots of Little House on the Prairie episodes that I saw once when I was 11, homesick from school.
Wow.
And that has been incredibly helpful in terms of, like, remembering stories. Like,
sure.
It's been very helpful because we'll be breaking a story in the room and I'll go, this reminds me of something. And I'll go, ooh, there was an episode of Growing Pains where X, Y, and Z happened. And so that is my thing. Memory is my thing. There are many things that are very much not my thing.
Yeah.
I get lost almost everywhere I go and drive anywhere or walk anywhere
sure.
or anything, even places I've been hundreds and hundreds of times. Have I talked about this before?
No.
Now I can't remember. There goes my argument that I have a good memory. But I talk about this a lot because I am constantly, you know, in the movie Memento,
sure.
how Guy Pearce has to constantly say to people, I have no short-term memory or whatever. And the people are like, yeah, we know. You've told us
right.
this already. That's me with directions
Mindy
and stuff.
Sinclair.
Yeah, like I go to restaurants with my wife and I'm like, this place is really nice. And yeah. she's like, we were here 2 weeks ago. And I'll be like, I have no memory of that.
I asked you in a previous episode of this podcast whether you were Michael or Chidi, and the answer is Janet, I guess. You're Janet. For episodes of Little Hearts on the Prairie.
For certain chunks of knowledge, I would say, yes, I'm more Janet than anybody else.
I suppose we should talk about episode 213 somewhere else.
Okay, fine.
In another sort of delightful recap, I love the moments when Jason Mendoza is like, guys, far be it from me, but I think we got to call the cops. And in this one, he says, can I tell you, like, this has been one of the craziest years of my life.
Yeah, and like, then Chidi's response is, one of?
Yeah. So much happens in this episode. Janet is becoming more human and expressing feelings, and so much so that she pops in and says, I love you,
mm-hmm.
to Jason Mendoza. When did you know that was coming?
I don't remember offhand exactly when we decided to do that, but it's an odd formulation this episode, because normally what would happen in a season finale is the thing that happens that's biggest would be the very end, right? You make
sure.
The big giant cliffhanger thing, the judge snapping her fingers. Eleanor is on Earth. She gets shoved out of the way by a mysterious white-haired stranger. The panel truck, the Engorgulate truck, hits the shopping carts, and she goes, whoa, I almost died. End of season, right? That was, in fact, at the beginning of the year when we were working with the writers, I think that's what we were talking about. That's the finale. That's the last moment of the season right
okay.
there. But the thing that we've done with this show, which has worked really well, is we've taken the biggest, juiciest thing and moved it from the very end of something into the middle of something.
Like the act one break or act two break.
Act one break or act two break, exactly. Or in the season one's case, Eleanor saying the person you're looking for is me happened at the end of episode 7, not at the end of episode 13.
Thank you,
and that has proven to be very exciting and fun and juicy and interesting. And it's given the show a ton of sort of narrative propulsion because you go past, you do something insane and you go past it and you get to something else insane. And it has this feeling of like, we're really packing the sardine tin really full of sardines. Weird metaphor, but it, stay with me. So we knew that this episode was going to be, the act one break was going to be Eleanor on Earth. And then we were going to just mostly just follow Eleanor.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, we were like, okay, well, a whole bunch of stuff has to happen in act one because we can't just leave all of the rest of the characters dangling. We have to know something about what we're looking forward to next year or whatever.
Sure.
So it was like, all right, well, what are the juiciest things that could happen based on what we've been building to? And one of them is Janet saying, I love you to Jason, and another, and then Chidi seeing that and looking over at Eleanor and realizing that he feels the same way about her and going over and laying one on her, as she puts it.
He lays one on her. Is that the first we've seen that? Like, that, it seems so dramatic. Although I feel as though, I mean, we've seen them in bed together.
Yeah. I don't think we've seen to this point. I mean, we certainly haven't seen from his point of view. We've seen her sit him down and say, I think I love you.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I love you. That was in 110, maybe.
I'm rolling my eyes because that's amazing that you would even be able to ballpark where that fall.
And we've certainly seen indications about how the two of them feel about
sure,
each other.
Sure, but I mean, obviously it's dramatic because it's decision on his part, which is new.
The biggest thing about it wasn't even that he kisses her, because we have seen at this point, we know that the two of them have a sort of 802 reboot long epic love story.
Right.
It was more just, he looks over at her, you see her from his point of view, and he very sort of straightforwardly and confidently just sort of walks over and is like, this is how I feel, this is what I'm going to do. That is like, if you needed a marker of his progress as a person,
mm-hmm.
Through all of these reboots, I would say that was the best, we figured that was the best way to sort of explain how he's different now than he was before.
For a guy that once tried to rent socks, like that's...
and a guy who two episodes earlier, or one episode earlier at that point, was given a test to choose between two hats. And it took him like 3 hours and he didn't make a choice.
Right.
Until he had to.
Something wonderful happens, which is that the notion of a individual medium place is pitched. And they're like, oh, as long as we can be together. And it's like, I don't think you're listening. They're individual and whatever. And then the judge, played by Maya Rudolph. I guess we should talk about Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, do we have to?
I mean, how did you ask her? When did you ask her?
So I've known Maya for a long time because we were on SNL together.
Mm-hmm.
And Maya is, and I say this lovingly, an assassin.
Mm-hmm.
She is a comedy assassin. There, yeah. She does a thing, no matter what she's doing, she makes every single thing she does as funny as it can possibly be.
Are you referring to Looney Tunes?
Looney Tunes. She, part of what makes her incredible to me is she does a thing that should be annoying.
Yeah.
Which is she puts mustard on every line.
Yep.
She does not take a single line off.
Mm-mm.
She finds a
way.
How
does it work?
I don't know.
Because it should be terrible.
It should not work.
You should two takes in and be going, can you just read it?
Can you just say the words? Yes.
Yeah.
And any other performer in the world.
In the world.
You would say, just say the words. But with her, you're like, no, keep
more.
Spinning. Spin more.
Yeah.
Put more topspin on that line. Great. Well, like, I haven't worked with her a ton since SNL.
Okay.
But I don't think I've ever even it's not just that I've never given her a suggestion or a note or
sure.
Like a,
No.
It's that I've never had an idea of what that would be. Like,
right.
I've never had the thought in my head of like, oh, I should give this actor this suggestion, because everything she does is hilarious, and also she doesn't ever do it the same way twice. So you could give her a note if you want to, but you might as well just wait and let her do whatever the next thing is that she's going to do.
Were the words Looney Tunes in the script?
Yes.
Okay. Because I could also see it being that she's like, it's crazy, it's bananas. And then a different take going like, it's crazy, it's bananas, it's Looney Tunes. And then eventually getting to Looney Tunes. But like, no, that's the
Looney
muster.
Tunes was that's, scripted, but yeah. She was like, now watch this.
Watch.
And I just love her so much. As a human being, I love her. And as a performer. And so when we were looking, we were like, obviously, we're very careful on the show not to say that anyone is, quote, God, end quote. Right?
Sure.
Like, Michael is not God.
Just
and Sean.
Sean
is not God.
Just Sean
no,
is God.
No.
Just Sean is God.
Mark, no.
That's my objective opinion, objective fact, now and forever.
But also, like, we have met some other people and some other, you know, creatures in the afterlife, mm-hmm. in the various power structures. But now we're going to meet the judge with a capital J. And even though we were very careful not to say that the judge is God.
Because she's not. Just
because she's not.
Just shown us.
No. We were like, well, regardless, this person who plays this role has to have a commanding presence,
yeah.
and has to be the kind of person where a combination of sort of gravitas and being in control of one's instrument as an actor, but then also just really funny.
Right.
And so as soon, the great thing about Maya is as soon as Maya signs on, the writing staff just go, like, we all crack our knuckles.
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
just like, here we go.
Game on.
And and you can write anything you want. And we're like, there's gonna be a lengthy sequence where she's eating a burrito. And with
it's
hot sauce,
it's
actually the concept of envy.
Yeah.
And you just throw that at her and you don't have to give her any, you don't have to tell her anything. She just is like, she's a comedy savant. That's what she is. That's the best term for it. She's a savant. She's like, there's no aspect of comedy that she cannot, that she's not familiar with and an expert in.
You do another thing here, another snap, like another reality undoing horrific snap that mm-hmm. happens so cavalierly. We've seen it before and it's never not unsettling. And then you do a really interesting thing, which is for 1/8 of a second, you snap to Kristen's eyes and we wonder if it's a reboot.
Right.
That's obviously deliberate because you use it later in a montage as well.
Right.
Including like sleepy reboot eyes and like messy hair reboot eyes as she's, you know, beginning to fall off.
Right.
But for a moment we think, oh my gosh, are we going to be back in the initiation room outside Michael's office? And it's not. We're back on Earth.
Yeah. So every time you've seen the close-up of the eyes opening, those eyes have stared straight ahead. The pupils have dilated. You've then jumped back to see the person sitting on a couch. And I was just like, well, if we're doing a snap, but it's different, then you ought to trick people.
Yeah.
And have that moment of like, this is the same thing I've seen before, but it's different. I can't explain why. And it's because she squints.
Oh.
Because what she's listening to is the guy behind her saying, why are you like this?
Oh,
he's
right,
saying,
right.
Why are you like this? Yeah. And she squints her eyes in anger. And it's very disconcerting because you've never seen... When you've ever seen those eyes open on this show, it's always been in the same exact way, which is this the sort of pleasant awaking from some kind of mysterious afterlife slumber.
Right.
And then just sort of like looking around. And so seeing them in the harsh light of Southern California sun, or in the world of the show, Arizona sun, and then squint in fury was just very kind of, it was the perfect way to make that transition, I think, because it's like it was before, but a little different. That was the idea.
I have some business to attend to, but I have a couple quick questions before we go to an ad or to a clip and such. Who pushes Eleanor out of the way?
Do you really not know?
I really don't know.
It's Michael. Yes, Michael pushes her out of the way, yes.
Was it Ted Danson?
No.
Okay.
It was a stunt performer
okay.
dressed like Ted Danson.
In a
powder blue polo in an Arizona 65-year-old man outfit, which
yeah.
is a powder blue polo and chinos. He pushed her out of the way. Both Ted and Kristen were there on the day, and Ted did parts of the stunt, meaning moving towards Eleanor and then also walking away afterwards.
That was him walking between cars?
Yes.
Interesting.
Well, I actually think in the take we used for the angle that we thought was best for the show, I think it's actually the stunt performer.
Okay.
Kristen did her part of the stunt, but for the actual part where the where the she needed to be thrown. That was so she did the, when you see her from the low angle, you see her face with her eyes wide where the guy grabs her. He was just grabbing her. The carts were not rushing towards her in that take.
That's from two years ago.
Yeah.
Is it from the original?
No.
Oh, okay.
We remounted the whole thing.
Wow.
In the same parking lot with the same people.
Interesting.
But for the one where you see actually the carts actually just missing the person who looks like Eleanor, mm-hmm. that is not Kristen. That is also a stunt performer.
Sure, because
and they were great.
Kristen is valuable.
Well, as are the stunt performers, but they're also just trained in this kind of action. Yeah, they're so good, and their timing was amazing. It wasn't like crashing a motorcycle into a car in Mission Impossible 15 or whatever it was, but it was still a tricky stunt because it was shopping carts racing forward. The camera was in motion.
Mm-hmm.
The male performer had to throw the female performer onto the ground as close to the carts as possible. Mm-hmm. The carts are being pulled by a wire in order to make them move. And then they have to do it in such a way that you don't see their faces. They're so good.
Yeah.
Like, because they fall and tumble and roll in a way where you can't ever see that it's not the real actors, and it's flawless.
When, I think an episode earlier, when Jason lands through the portal, that stunt is amazing.
That's amazing.
That dude flips.
Flipping and twisting like, in the air.
Twisting
and,
yeah. seven times, it looks like. That's yeah. crazy. The last thing before I go to something. Eleanor says, she goes back to her roommates and she said, I almost just died. This thing happened and I was frozen.
Yeah.
Is that
not intentional?
Really?
No, it was just
That's
written
not
that
a
way.
Nod to...
Kristen pointed it out to me on the set. And I was like, oh, do you want to change it? That's so thoughtless. I mean, she was like, no, who cares? It's totally fine. But it did seem like a weird little nod to my daughter's former favorite movie of all time.
Oh, no. What's the new one?
Well, she's
Kong
at the time,
Skull Island?
Yeah, it was Kong Skull Island. Yeah. Well, there's one actor in particular in Kong Skull Island that she's a fan of.
John Goodman.
But when Frozen, I'll tell this little anecdote.
Sure.
When Frozen came out, my daughter, who I think was four okay. or five, saw it. I don't know, 140 times.
Sure.
And on her, I'm going to say, fifth birthday, I ran into Kristen and Dax at the Arclight
oh, wow.
movie theater. And I said, hey, I have to tell you, thank you for Frozen. It's my daughter, seen it 140 times, and it's her favorite movie. And it's her birthday soon, and she's having a Frozen-themed birthday party, which was true. And Kristen, without me asking her, said, oh, do you want me to call you and leave her a message, a voicemail message as what? Princess Anna. And I was like, hell yes, I do. So Kristen called my phone and left this long message as in her Kristen voice as Princess Anna of Arendelle. Is that what it is? I think. And it was like, hi, Ivy. I'm here in Arendelle and I'm with Olaf and we're just celebrating and we're so happy that it's your birthday. And just this like 2.5 minute long thing. And So on Ivy's birthday, I came downstairs and I was like, Ivy, guess what? Guess who wished you a happy birthday today? And I played the message for her and she just sat there and listened to it wide-eyed and like uncomprehending, happy and stunned and thrilled and uncomprehending. And it got to the end and she was speechless. And I was like, do you want me to play it again? And she nodded. So I played it again and we listened to the whole thing and it got to the end and I said, isn't that so cool? And she just burst into tears.
Oh.
Just out of like pure joy and childlike confusion and
sure.
happiness and like
Santa
exhilaration.
Claus
Santa Claus called her and said hi.
Right.
And
oh my
I
gosh.
Was like, oh, Ivy, oh, no. And she was just like, but it was like happy. It was happy, explosive crying. And so I called Kristen. I sent her an email, I think, and I said, I just want you to know that you made my daughter so happy that she can't stop crying.
Oh my goodness, yeah. What a lovely story.
Yeah, that's Kristen Bell.
Kristen Bell's all right.
Yeah.
Episodes of The Good Place can be seen on NBC.com or the NBC app. Let's listen to a clip.
You know the thing is, the problem really with being a do-gooder?
What's that?
No one cares. I mean, some people care a little bit. Warpy little twerps from the environmental place, they care. But I was a good person for 6 months. That's like 5 years. And it felt okay, but not as good as I thought it would. And what did I get for it?
Ah, see, now you're talking about moral desert.
Exactly. Wait, I am what?
Moral desert is the concept that if you act with virtue, you deserve a reward.
Right. If I'm not gonna get rewarded somehow with like a tiara or one of those diagonal word belts.
Sash.
Sure.
Sash.
Then why should I do good things?
You know, I had a friend that said whenever she was doing something bad, she'd hear this little voice in her head, distant little voice saying, oh, come on now. You know this is wrong. And then when she started doing good things, that voice went away. It was a relief.
Your friend sounds like she's one pickle short of a pickle party.
She was a little rough around the edges, but she was also a really good person when she tried. See, I think that little voice was her conscience trying to guide her in the right direction.
I gotta go home. What do I owe you?
The real question, Eleanor, is what do we owe to each other?
This
forking
show. I mean, it's so good, man. You must recognize it. There were like multiple things just in that clip. I mean, first of all, camera pans over. We find Ted Danson behind a bar tossing a bar mop, a towel over his shoulder.
Yeah. At some level, this entire show was just a long con to get to the point where I could put Ted Danson behind a bar again. And now I'm done. I can walk away.
Game over. I mean, it's I don't know why. I mean, yes, I do. That is such a reassuring image. Like,
yeah.
It's so familiar. It's obvious, you know, for those that are under 100, it's a reference to Cheers, which was on for 1,000 seasons.
I never saw it, but I've heard it's good.
You have seen it, and I know you've seen it because you have a little House on the Prairie memory for some certain things about it. I don't know, like, it was a moment in American television history to see him back behind that bar. Like, I wasn't there. I didn't know that that was going to happen. And to see it when I watched it as a fan in my office at home was thrilling and really deeply satisfying.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things about it that are satisfying, I would say. Number one is that the character of Michael exists the way it exists because of Ted, in the sense that the whole show in season one was predicated on this idea that you could wake up in the afterlife and be told you're dead and feel okay about it. And the way that you could feel okay about it is if Ted Danson were the one telling you.
Yeah.
Like, and he just has there, he is so calming and stentorian and reassuring and loving as an actor. I mean, it's not like he's the only person in the world who could do that, but he's the best one in my
best
mind.
Best one ever, yeah.
So you start there, right? And you say, well, this character is a father figure to all of the people in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the gravitas to to not only fake being God, but also to show up in a bar and dispense some advice to someone who doesn't appear to know him and have it resonate. And you know, look, I've said this so many times. I'll say it again. Cheers is the greatest comedy of all time. Sam Malone's the best character of all time. Ted Danson's interpretation of Sam Malone is the best interpretation of any character in television history, in my opinion. I don't know that you'll ever beat it. For TV shows to work, especially ones that last as long as Cheers, the people running the show have to make 200 million consecutive good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what is so impressive to me about that show is, from a writing standpoint and a casting standpoint and from the set design and from the people they added and the characters they added and the long arc of the show, the actors who left and the actors who replaced them, they just made every right decision in a row. So you take all of that and you say, well, at the center of that show was Ted Danson playing Sam Malone, the best character ever, played by the best TV actor ever. And now, many years later, 28 years or whatever after he last said, sorry, we're closed, and that show ended, you put him behind a bar again. It was a dream come true, and we didn't take it lightly. I asked his permission in the same way that one might ask permission to marry one's daughter.
Yeah.
I said, is it okay if we do this? And he said, oh yeah, totally, of course. He later said that it was very scary for him and that he didn't particularly like it.
He said it on this podcast. Yeah,
that's right.
Because of the machismo thing of like the coming onto a woman kind of thing. And obviously this is an entirely different context. This is very parental and...
Yeah. And it's, you know, in a different world, and in fact, in the real world, that pairing of Ted Danson and Kristen Bell has sexualized overtones, right? Like there are worlds in which we actually, I don't want to spoil anything, but there are, at some point in season three, someone makes a comment about that dynamic, but I won't spoil it, but it happens late in the middle of season three and it's enjoyable. It's you'll see. So, but what is so wonderful about the performance that he gave in this episode is there is nothing remotely creepy about it. It could be creepy so easily. It's a pedagogical relationship at some point. Mm-hmm. She's very drunk. She's dressed to the nines. She's Kristen Bell. She's a very attractive human being.
She's a smoke show.
Yeah, and she's in a bar, and she's not like the kind of person who wouldn't hit on an older gentleman bartender.
Right.
But the relationship is so well drawn at this point by those two actors that there is no hint of creepiness or of inappropriateness. Like he's listening patiently to her story. She's telling her story. He's giving her advice. She's making jokes. He's deflecting them. He's steering her in the right direction. It is a completely innocent scene just acted by two excellent actors.
It's lovely that he tells this story about a friend of his. That's obviously her without her knowledge.
Right.
And her little voice, which is sort of, I wonder, in the writer's room, do you think of the little voice being the same or related to Eleanor's antenna about looking for people, you know, to screw her over early on? And
no,
then...
those are two different things.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. The antenna is her life experiences have built up to the point where she now is very sensitive to the idea of people trying to take advantage of her or people big-timing her or seeming superior to her or trying to screw her over or any of that stuff. That's learned behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that is her missile defense system of life.
Okay.
The little voice in her head...
Which he even labels her conscience.
Yes. That's more of that. We are sort of positing at some level that everybody has that.
Okay.
That you have, as you walk around Earth, if you do something crappy, if you toss a coffee cup at a garbage can and it misses and falls onto the ground, you can walk away. Anyone can walk away from that.
Sure.
But in the moment you make the decision to walk away, you just have this little feeling of like, I shouldn't do this.
Right.
And everyone has that voice, I believe. Everyone has, it's a basic level. I mean, I'm leaving aside, you know, sociopaths or people who just are not part of this sort of human conversation. But aside from those people, from the extreme ends of the bell curve, you have a little voice in your head that tells you when you're not being great. And you have it when you're in talking to your friends and telling white lies to your friends. Every time you tell a white lie to a friend to get out of a dinner you don't want to go to or to cover up the fact that you made a social faux pas or whatever, every time you do that, there's just a little tiny distant alarm bell that's like, this isn't the right thing to do. And you know it.
Sure.
You can ignore it.
Yeah.
And many people do. I do all the time. Everybody does. Like there are times, arguably, where it's better to mute it in order to make the world move in a better, have the gears grind and mesh of human interaction and all that sort of stuff. However, it doesn't go away. You can mute it, but it's there. And I have, especially since starting this show, that voice is annoyingly loud.
Is it screaming?
Oh my God. I mean, I'm extremely aware of my own flaws. And I think I always have been, like I've always felt a certain amount of guilt or frustration at my own flaws and lackings and failings. But since this show started, I will be completely alone in my office and I will throw a gum wrapper at the garbage can. And if it misses, the little voice goes, Hey, dummy, pick that up. That's not anyone else's problem. That is your problem. You created that. Pick it up.
Oh, you should talk to someone. You should seek. I agree with you completely. I have had the same thing because it's, you know, steeping in this stuff, marinating in this stuff definitely brings it to the fore and makes you think about it. I also, you know, this show has made me on a personal level more recognizable. So it's a little, it's that plus the Truman Show of like, people are watching.
You know, yeah, what I mean? Well, sure.
Yeah.
Well, there's a whole interesting part of philosophy about, there's a little wing of philosophy about shame. Mm. And shame is like, it's hotly contested and debated about whether it's good or bad, whether it can have positive or negative effects or whatever.
Yeah.
And there is certainly like, there's a place in the world for shame in the sense that if there are people who are behaving terribly,
yeah,
it's part of human evolution that like the community makes them feel bad
call
about
it out.
Yeah, call it out. And, yeah. And it's not something that I particularly think is good or that I particularly want to indulge in a lot, but sometimes it's a very powerful and potent tool for good.
Sure.
It can also be a potent tool for evil, as many things can be,
sure.
Both one or the other. But I think all the time about, I mean, with hilariously, so in the season two finale, mm-hmm. Eleanor, oh, well, that's what we're talking about.
Welcome. Everything is fine. Everything is great.
I was like, I got to go way off track here and talk about the season two finale.
Yeah.
That's literally the thought in my head. So I forgot where I am. I don't know who any of you are. Who are you people?
I'm Sean. I play God.
So Eleanor, in her year, one of the things that happens is she's pulling into a parking lot and she bumps into a car.
Right.
And she leaves and she's like,
she's driving a hybrid, by the way.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah.
She's like, I got to do the right thing here. She leaves a note and says, sorry, I bumped your car, whatever. And she gets sued for like $100 billion.
For whiplash, yeah.
Right. So less than 1 week after filming that episode, I was pulling into a parking spot on the side of the street in Los Angeles and I totally misjudged. Very, very out of character for me. I'm an extremely cautious driver.
Sure.
I just totally misjudged the angle and I crunched a car. And I immediately
sped off.
Yeah. And I changed my name and I left my family and I moved to North Dakota. I had this feeling of like fury at myself for being a ding dong and of annoyance at how annoying this was going to be. However, I also then immediately just started laughing because I was like, I can't believe 4 days ago we shot this exact scene. So I did the thing. And by the way, this isn't like, it's not like before the show, I would have done something else. I would never have sped off and written a note.
Right.
But I wrote this long note. I said, here's my phone number. Here's my cell phone number. Here's my work number. Here's 150 different ways to get in touch with me. I'm very, very sorry. Please accept my apology. Call me. I'll pay for everything. So the woman calls me and she goes, hi, thank you for leaving the note. And I was like, of course, I completely blew it. I'm so sorry because these things are so annoying. And she said, she was very, very nice. And she said, actually, a month ago, someone else hit me and left a note in my car. And I just got my car back from the dealer like yesterday.
Oh.
I was like, oh God, I am so sorry. And she was like, no, it's totally fine. Accidents happen. And I was like, please just send me the bill. And it ended up being like the most pleasant. She was very happy that I had left a note and hadn't just sped away and changed my name and moved to North Dakota. And I was grateful to her for being so understanding about my own failing and lack of acumen in parking a car. And it ended up being this really lovely little thing that was just like, this is how it should go, right? It was 100,000% my fault. And so I was excessively apologetic and accommodating of however she wanted to handle it. And she was incredibly understanding and forgiving of the fact that people make mistakes and things happen and it's okay. And it was like such a nice yin-yang to the scene that we had shot with Eleanor where that had happened and she had done the right thing and the person whose car she had done the exact wrong thing. And it gave me a little kind of wave of hope and happiness about like maybe it's possible that as human beings we can actually have things like this happen and it'll come out okay.
It's what we owe to each other.
Yeah, that's right.
Promotional consideration is furnished by the following totally real advertiser.
In the beating heart of downtown southeastern Scottsdale, this former Circuit City now houses Arizona's number 6 celebrity-owned wine bar and hot yoga studio, Sting's Desert Rosé Wine Bar, right next to Thunder Dan Marley's Fast Break Tomahawk Dunk Auto Parts.
In one of the act openers, you use, I think for the first time ever, sort of a voiceover narration as a device. Eleanor says, I'm Eleanor Shellstrop, and I've been a bad person and I want to change that or whatever. Was that a script fix? Later, that sort of manifests when we see a year later, her Facebook reminder is basically that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, so she comes back and she talks to her two jerk roommates.
Yeah.
They do the thing that everybody does. Well, not everybody, but most people does, which is they make it about themselves and they talk about their near-death experiences, which are not in any way near-death experiences. That, by the way, came from, I was in New York on 9/11, mm-hmm. and I lived on 16th Street.
Oh, wow.
But also, I was never in danger, right?
Like, I guess so.
It was terrifying and haunting, and I will, like, remember those, like, 3 weeks for the rest of my life. But
Syracuse is about 7 hours away.
Yes. And so that was a commentary on a number of people I know who were in New York and who were far less close to downtown Manhattan than I was, who still talk about it like it was the most harrowing experience. Like, they were in Syracuse only 3 weeks earlier, and
right.
who knows what could have happened. They barely escaped death. So anyway, that's a side note. So she goes in and she writes that essentially Facebook post, and we were going to have it just be typed on the screen, but it just works better to hear it.
It's more active.
And it helps to, like, explain the story, and you get to use it as narration as you see her sort of straightening up a room and making some changes and throwing stuff away and giving stuff to Goodwill. And it just worked better as narration. So we broke our own little template and decided to do that for the first time.
It's right. It's effective. And it does seem like not a different show, but it seems like a fresh take on it, sort of along the lines of when we see the montage coming up, Eleanor decides to become a better person. She quits her shady job. Mm-hmm. She agrees to go to a baby shower. She approaches and apologizes to the environmental dude. She herself becomes horny for the environment, it seems, and joins the team.
Yeah.
All while Michael and Janet are watching ticker tapes, monitoring the progress kind of thing. Not that it's a new show, but it lands it as authentic and that it's not some Michael-driven simulation. Like, this is real. We're back on Earth.
Yep.
She's alive. I almost said she never died. And it's like, well, no, she totally did die 800 times,
yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
That part was real.
But in this timeline, she didn't. And there's a lot of different things. We did a lot of different things. For one thing, we use a needle drop. A music cue, which we almost never do.
I was going to ask you about that. It's Maybe by the Submarines.
Yes.
And it's peppy and positive, I guess.
But it's also
indecisive?
Yeah. Well, if you listen, the lyrics of the chorus are maybe, maybe, maybe I'm wrong. And I was just driving around at some point in the, when I was writing and I can't remember, and that song came on. And I had heard that song a million times. I like that song. But suddenly, somehow, it like resonated, and I was like, oh, this makes sense to me. I don't know why. It was it's a little maudlin. It's peppy, but it's also a little maudlin, and it's saying, like, I don't know, like, who knows? Maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, maybe this is good, maybe it's bad. The last lines are, the last verse starts, it's also sung by two different people, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Oh.
Also, when I looked them up on Wikipedia, I believe the woman, half of the duo, her name in real life, I think, is Eleanor, which I was like, oh, maybe that's a sign. So anyway, we did a lot of different things, and that was just to say, like, well, yeah, we're back on Earth now. Like, the world is different. Their characters' world are different. I guess the show should be a little different, too.
Writer Dan Schofield, the one that does a great impression of me doing Sean, makes a cameo in this episode. He,
yes.
I think, is signing up to register to vote or for the environment in a park, right?
Dan is a very quiet person.
Yes.
And he was on the set that day just helping out as a writer to, pitch jokes or to, like, give another set of eyes. And I've known him since 1994. Four or five, I think. He and I went to college together. He's a couple years younger than me.
Oh.
And he's very quiet and he's very shy and he's very retiring. And I was like, oh, I'm going to make you be on TV.
That was done to you, right?
It was done
by,
to me.
Yes, Greg Daniels as Moe's.
That was more direct torture. That was more like Greg just, like, hazing me. But in this case, it was just fun. Even though he didn't have to talk, he was so white knuckle terrified to be on television.
It reads very natural.
He's like, I'll look at your thing. Good. I'll sign up. Yeah.
Right. Then we, Eleanor and her continuing efforts to come clean and live a righteous life, confesses about the dress bitch stuff to Angela Trimber. And at the end of that scene, a waiter enters offering steamed vegetables, and that waiter is played by casting director Ben Harris.
Correct.
Yeah.
Ben Harris,
which I missed until I was yesterday rewatching this episode for the billionth time and then going through IMDb for the guest cast. He's listed, and I didn't realize that was him.
Yes.
He's shot sort of in a master, kind of long.
Yeah.
You never really push in on him.
It's Allison Jones and Ben Harris, who were on this podcast and were delightful. I was like, we need this waiter. It's only like one or two lines. And Allison was like, how about Ben? And I was like, oh, of course. Of course, Ben. Ben is a delightful person.
He really is.
And he did a great job.
So Eleanor backslides. Things get harder. She eventually goes back to her job at what is basically Trump University.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's a Ponzi scheme within a Ponzi scheme.
Right. And she needs another push. So that's when she goes to see Michael. And it was really interesting to realize that through the device of the Facebook reminder thing of like, hey, this is from a year ago, that it was a whole year.
Yeah. Yeah. We wanted it to be a long time. For a long time in the writer's room, we talked about this episode as the New Year's resolution episode. And its simple idea was, it's very easy on January 2nd to wake up and go to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty easy to do it on January 3rd and
4th. Slightly less easy.
But on February 16th, when you've gone to the gym four times a week for like six straight weeks and you wake up and you're just a little tired and you had three glasses of wine the night before and you're not feeling great, it starts to get harder and you say, I'll just skip today. It's fine. I've been so good. I'll just skip today.
Yeah.
And then I'll go tomorrow. And then it's April 30th and you haven't gone
ice cream for breakfast.
Yeah. And so like the fun of this was like, in order to tell that story of like a person with a tremendous motivation and a new lease on life and a real feeling of like, I'm changing stuff, like to tell the story of the like slow dissolve of that drive and resolve, you can't do it over a week.
It's gotta be time.
Or even a month. It's gotta be a year. And
so
we, you know, about 7 or 8 months in, the environmental guy shows up and is like, hey, what gives? And she's like, well, I've been doing this forever and I've got nothing to show for it. Like at that point, she's like, the job doesn't pay very well. And she gets sued by the jerk whose car she hit. And and it's just sort of like, yeah, it's hard, man. And that's what she says to Michael in the bar, right? It's like, what?
Moral dessert.
Like, it's hard to get away from that feeling personally.
Sure.
Like, you do feel like you should get a prize. Like, if you do a lot of good stuff, at some level, some deep-seated thing in all of us is looking for someone to pin a blue ribbon to our shirt and give us a trophy. And the flip side of this is that you see people all the time who are evil and bad
succeed,
getting a lot of trophies,
yeah,
like in a lot of different ways. They get rich and they get successful and then they get big
elected.
Yeah, they get elected to office. Yes. And so at some level, it's like, well, if you get all this stuff for being bad,
right,
and you get nothing really for being good,
yeah,
what the hell? And that's why it's my favorite moment in the episode is when she says, being good is for suckers. What do you even get out of it? And the man from the environmental place says, a feeling of fulfillment in your soul. And she takes a beat and then she says, gross. That is the grossest thing I've ever heard. It's such a great performance by Kristen. But it is like at some level, it's like, yeah, that's why you're doing this. You're doing this to feel fulfilled in your soul. And that's all you can ever expect. And if you don't realize the inherent truth in that, and also if you can't be cool with that, it's awfully hard to be good every day. And it's a struggle. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing for me. You know, for the average person, I think it's not easy to live your life with that as the reward. And it's a daily grind. You got to grind it out.
Which is, I think, different than pounding it out, right? There are some sort of housekeeping things that the internet wanted to ask about, and I think that you address this coming up in season three, and I've heard you talk about it at panels and things. When we're in Australia, we meet Chidi Anna Kendrick,
right?
And he's not speaking with a Senegalese accent.
Correct.
Do you care to address that?
The complete picture will be laid out in the premiere, if anyone's interested.
I doubt it. This audience? Forget it.
But the short answer is, well, actually, that's not true. This is a long answer. So we had a long debate, right? Should he speak? In the pilot, Chidi says, she says, your English is amazing. And he says, oh, I'm speaking French.
Right.
I think this place just translates whatever you say into whatever language you understand. And that's cool. And when I made a list when I was writing the pilot of like 57 things that I thought needed to be answered or understood, mm-hmm. Including how would people from all parts of the world communicate with each other? Was it magic? Were they all speaking a new language, whatever? And it was like, this is the one I settled on. It automatically just translates, sure. Right? Which made sense to me. I never thought at that point we would be going back to Earth and seeing Chidi on Earth. And then when we did flashbacks, I was like, well, I could have him speak in a Senegalese accent, but I felt like just for rhythm and comedy and simplicity, it was like, we're in the magical world of the show now. Right. Our touchstone for this was The Hunt for Red October, if you remember that excellent film.
I watch it like twice a week.
It's the best.
I know exactly what you're about to
Sean
say.
Sean Connery plays a Russian man.
Yeah.
Sean Connery, this is how I imagined it happened. They were like, so Sean, you're going to do a Russian accent. And he said, no, I'm not. And they were like, okay, now we'll figure out how to work around
this. And roll camera.
And the roll camera and action. And so what happens is he's talking in Russian. The camera pushes into his mouth.
He's reading the quote about the end of time.
That's right. And then it pulls back. And now he's magically speaking English with a Scottish accent. So, and they were just like, look, this is a movie. Just relax. It's fine. He's a Russian. You get it. And so I was like, well, that's our touchstone for this is we're just going to say, now you've heard Chidi speak English, flawless English.
Sure.
And so anything else might do more harm than good. So he's going to speak English in these flashbacks. And then now we're in a world where he's back on Earth and now we really got to explain it. So it is totally explained in the premiere. Everyone who is interested in that explanation will get it within minutes of the season 3 premiere.
Let's talk about this with that in mind. One could try to suss. They could, look at Instagram photos and think about who's tweeted that they worked on the show or whatever, and they could piece together things from this podcast, trying to figure out what season 3 is. And I would just ask, to what end? why? Don't. Trust Mike Schur. Trust Drew Goddard. Trust, the writers of the show and the producers and the actors of the show. Absent the context of the season, we could tell you anything specific. We could tell you facts about what was shot and what the script said, and it won't make any sense.
Yeah.
I think just trust and enjoy.
Well, look, I'm reticent to tell any fan of anything how he or she should engage with that thing, right? It's like, if that's your bag, if sussing is your bag,
okay,
then suss away, my friends.
All right.
I feel like the 10 greatest moments of my entertainment consuming life have been surprises, surprises in movies, not having been spoiled for things, seeing things that were the anticipation of watching, sitting down to watch something, especially like in a TV show where you know something is going to happen and you don't know what it is. And I would cite among those, I saw The Usual Suspects. My friend was like, let's go see this movie, The Usual Suspects. And I was like, I've never heard of it, but okay, fine.
Right.
And then the end of that movie, without knowing anything about that movie, was truly mind-blowing and it has stayed with me. I talk about The Usual Suspects ending constantly in the room is like, that's the gold standard. To me, that is the absolute gold standard for shocking people and coming up with a twist or a reveal, because it's not Deus Ex Machina, right? It's totally earned.
It's within the device.
It's the careful laying of brick after brick after brick after brick. And then you get to the end and the thing that has been built was completely different from what you thought was being built. Mm-hmm. It's still the gold standard to me, more than The Sixth Sense, which other people cite.
Sure.
The Sixth Sense I went to see and I guessed the ending halfway through the movie and I was so annoyed. I'm not good at that. I'm not particularly good at guessing, but I guessed that. And so that was a bummer. But going into the final season of Breaking Bad, for example, having been with that show from the beginning, and knowing, I don't know. I met Vince Gilligan halfway through. They did it. Their final season was split, 7 and 6. They took a break between the last two chunks. And I met Vince Gilligan, and we did some kind of panel together. And I told him that I had this feeling when I drove around Los Angeles, which was, I hope I don't die. Not because it would make my family sad or anything.
Great
but
save.
Because I need to know what happens. And that's remarkable. To create a show that causes that feeling in people is nothing. What's better than that as a writer or a producer or whatever. And so, like, the to me, if you want to suss, if you want to piece together clues, if that's what gets your motor running, then fine. That's totally fine. It's a sign of engagement and of interest in people that they would do that. So I would never say, like, don't. I would never wag my finger and scold them. However, I find personally that truly being surprised by entertainment is about as good as it gets in the human experience outside of, like, you know, romantic love,
sure.
or familial love. And so I never do it. I'm very spoiler phobic. I don't try to learn anything about anything, and I don't want to know. I don't even want to know who's, like, making. I don't want to know that Rian Johnson is directing the next Star Wars movie, because I have seen Rian Johnson's other movies and my brain will start to imagine what it might look like, and I don't want to think about it. I just want to go watch it.
Looper in space.
Yeah. That would be, by the way, super cool.
So I would watch that. I would, Rian, I would also be in it. you've done it with these on this show. You've made us feel deeply about completely made up pretend characters.
Well, that's good.
And you know, we will have just talked about the episode where Michael sacrifices himself and says he solved the trolley problem, and he pins the senior staff pin on Eleanor and pushes her through. Like, that's an emotional thing. When this gets undone, when at the end of this episode we're talking about, when Michael says, "Okay, here we go."
Yeah,
like, it's emotional.
That was a somewhat late add to the script, and it's because the very first words of the season are also, "Okay, here we go." It's the first thing he says in the season before he calls Sean to try to sell him on how
that's
great
cool,
this is gonna go.
Mike.
It is cool.
That's cool.
And I was sort of like, okay, well, this is Michael's season, and he convinces her, and she flies to Australia, and she walks in, and she says, "Are you Chidi and a Gagne?" Or Anna Kendrick, rather. can we talk? And I was like, what a great ending to the season. And I was like, no, it's not the right ending, because it's not her season, it's his season. And I was like, oh, you end it the way you bookend it. And the first time he said, okay, here we go, it was, okay, here we go, time to sell my demon boss on my awesome torture plan. And the second time he says, okay, here we go, many, many moons later, it's, okay, I think I've saved the souls of my four friends.
Wow.
It was cool.
This
forking
show.
I like it every time someone curses, because you get to hear Kristen pop in
mm-hmm.
and cover up. Can I do it? Maybe I should do it just because it would
please
be fun.
Please do, because I'm about to do it a lot.
Mark, I think you're doing a great
forking
job.
Thank you very much. Mike, it's not without help. In fact, the hosting of this podcast is probably the easiest part of it. It's not without the unbelievable work of Grant Rutter and Trey Booty and Lizzie Pace, who are all
forking
amazing. And the only reason I'm talking about this now is because this is the last episode of this podcast that will have any lead time for editing. So they're like, because it's going to be
forking
short after this. Like,
totally.
We'll get an advance of the next season. We'll
forking
watch it. They'll
forking
record a podcast about it. The
forking
episode will drop.
What kind of
forking assholes
are making you do this? Where, like, we have to record a
forking
podcast that
forking
close to the time the show's
forking
airing.
Can I tell you something? It's also going to be super
forking
difficult, because I'm not going to have any. I can't
forking
talk about the future episodes, and there's some of the
forking
future that I know about.
Yeah, no shirt.
So how that, like, these
assholes.
I mean,
fork
these guys.
What a bunch of mother
forking assholes.
Edit that. An overarching question that I've been meaning to ask you, what questions did you ask when you were looking for these writers, when you assembled the room? Because you mentioned that you knew Dan Schofield mm-hmm. from college, from, you know, since the 90s. But Andrew Law, you didn't. So you called Shoemaker and you called Seth, right? Mm-hmm. And what questions were you asking?
I asked no common questions, I would say. I was looking for a specific kind of person, and that person is a person who's intellectually curious. That was the only requirement. More so even than experience or a particular kind of writing or...
a philosophy degree.
Credit. Yeah, or like, philosophy didn't particularly matter, because the fun of this show in the writer's room is like asking a bunch of questions. And if you aren't intellectually curious, then it's not fun to ask questions and try to find the answers. And so Andrew, I believe, had taken like some philosophy classes.
I think he has a degree, yeah.
And not in philosophy. Maybe he does. I don't know.
Do you? He's outside.
But just talking to him and talking about the show and what I wanted out of the show, like you just saw his brain, his gear started grinding. And that was the main requirement. I mean, there were a lot of people, Megan and Joe and Jen, were all people I'd worked with before and I knew were great and wonderful. But the people that I hired that I hadn't worked with before, the only commonality, really, I would say, is they just seemed like they were interested in poking around and trying to ask questions and learn the answers.
Amazing. Mike Schur, may I tell you what's good?
Oh, please.
I believe that what's good is finding your people, finding people that you work well with, that lift you up, that make you want to do more and be better and be gooder. And I found my people through improvisation. I began studying improvisation years ago and later did it at the Second City in Detroit and now, of course, in Hollywood. And it's how I am in this business at all and know anything. And improvisation is something that everyone should check out. Whether you ever hope to be a performer or a comedian or a writer or a director, it's an amazingly positive and affirmative life skill. It's something that that lets you off the hook for having every answer, and you will make the best friends of your life, and it will instill a lot of confidence. And I believe in it so wholeheartedly that about 6 years ago, my wife and I and some of our friends from Detroit began the Detroit Creativity Project. We are a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, and we teach improv in middle and high schools in Detroit free of charge. We're at the end of a two-year study with the University of Michigan. I don't know if you've heard of that, Mike. And we have scientific data showing that kids who enter self-reporting for social phobia, social anxiety, and depression 10 weeks later have marked decrease in that. It's a great life skill, and I encourage people to check it out at dcpimprov.org. It's the Detroit Creativity Project. Mike, what's good?
Okay, so the first time you asked me this, I was unprepared.
Givewell.org.
The second time you asked me this, I was overprepared.
You had a nice list.
I had a nice list.
That ended poorly.
So I was thinking about, and with you.
Right.
Yeah. So I was thinking about how I was going to answer this today. And I have two answers, and they're both, no, I'm sorry. I have three answers, and they're all show related.
Great.
Okay. So answer number one, what's good, is Kristen Bell, American television actress Kristen Bell. So I single her out in this podcast because this episode was an episode of TV where we picked up the entire show and we put it on her shoulders. Mm-hmm. She carries almost the entire thing. From the act one break on, she's essentially the only cast member who talks except for Ted in the scene in the bar and Chidi at the very end.
Oh,
and
wow.
Jamila is not in the episode after the first act break, nor is Manny, nor is Darcy, really. And that was the design of this. The design of this was we're going to pick up the whole show. We're going to put it on Kristen Bell's shoulders and she's going to carry us into the promised land. And she is so good at her job. Mm-hmm. I really like, again, I've known her for a long time. I had never worked with her really before the show. She did a couple episodes of Parks and Rec and was wonderful. But I'm so impressed by her all the time. I'm so amazed by how effortlessly, she seems to do a very difficult job. It's very hard to be the main character of a TV show. I mm-hmm. know, I'm not saying it's hard by the standards of the universe, as digging ditches is hard.
You're not a Maya.
And,
right?
Yeah, exactly. However, the actual job itself within the category of actor is very difficult. You are asked to do a lot of things. You're asked to be funny, primarily on a comedy show. You're asked to be romantic when you need to be. You're asked to be dramatic when you need to be. You're asked to sometimes just dispense information. You're asked to be the glue that holds the whole thing together. And this entire cast is like a waking dream all the time in terms of their talent and their kindness as people. But Kristen, in this episode particularly, and in the show in general, is just so
forking
good their job. And it's just a joy. It's a joy to watch her work. I used to say at the beginning of the show, I said she's like a machine because of how fluidly she would learn her dialogue, how effortlessly she would deliver it, and how well she would deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped saying she was a machine because I realized that saying she's a machine implies that she's not in any way emotionally connected to her job. It implies that she's like a robot that you can wind up and set loose on a set. And the truth is she is very connected to her work, and she's digging into it all the time and finding color and nuance and shade in the language and in the role that we didn't even know was there. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank her publicly for being so
forking
good. Yeah. So that's answer number one. Answer number two is the writing staff of the show. It takes so many people to make a TV show. I was thinking, as you were talking about the ticker tape, I want to give a shout out to Gay Perello, the property master,
yeah,
who I was like, they need to be looking at some weird old-timey devices. I can't explain what they are, but that's the only word that makes any sense to me, is an old-timey device. And she showed up like 3 hours later and was like, look at these old, cool ticker tape machines. And I was like, oh,
like
my
stock
God,
tickers.
Perfect.
Old.
Yes. Yeah. It's like so perfect. Everyone on the show does such a good job, but the writing staff in particular, it's not an easy show to write. It's very nuanced and complicated, and we wander down a lot of dead ends, and we have a lot of, the show is a palimpsest of like version after version after version after version, and they just did a wonderful job. I'm thinking not just about season two, which we're wrapping up today with this podcast, but also season three, which I'm editing now. They did such a great job, and I'm very grateful to them for caring, really. All you can ever hope for as a showrunner is that there's anyone else in the world who cares about the thing that you're trying to make.
Who wants it to be good.
Yeah, and they care, and they want it to be good, and I'm eternally grateful. So thank you to the writing staff. And then the final answer is the fans of the show, because after the season three wrapped, Andrew Law and I were talking. It was actually his idea. He said we should try to rally the fans of the show to raise some money for a worthwhile charity. And so we put up a thing on CrowdRise where we said, let's try to raise $25,000 for KIND, the
Kids in Need of Defense,
who provides legal aid to immigrant children who are separated. Some of them are separated from their parents at the border. Others just need legal representation. The fans of the show, mostly in donations of like $10 and $25 and $50,
right,
raised $25,000 in less than 48 hours.
Yeah.
It was incredibly cool and inspiring. And the cast and crew and staff of the show is now going to match that donation. It's taken us a lot longer to get our act in gear than it did the fans of the show, but we're, as of today, we will hit our matching donation. So because of this simple act of generosity on part of the fans of the show, $50,000 is going to go to a very worthwhile charity and help kids, the most vulnerable human beings on earth, children separated at the border from their parents. So thank you to the fans of the show for doing that. That's my answer.
Mike Schur, thank you for The Good Place.
Don't you say it like that. It sounds like it's over, man. It sounds like a funeral.
I'm thankful. This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Now it's your turn. Go do something good.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. And now to deliver our credit sequence is Bad Janet. Take it away, Bad Janet.
Whatever. If you enjoyed this podcast, which, like, how is that even possible? Please subscribe. It's available on all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts. I don't even know. Or if you don't want to subscribe, you can also just listen to your mom's butt, you fat dink. You burnt.
Why don't I handle the credits? The podcast is hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Ew.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Who?
It's written by Lizzie Pace.
Okay.
And the music is composed by David Schwartz.
David Schwartz. See you next time, nerds.